So the final panel is a sort of industry wrap-up. It's less formal. There are no PowerPoint presentations. People are simply going to give us a very brief sense of where the industry is at this point, and then we'll just have more of a discussion about the issues that are generated by the conversation. You've already met Alan. Zdeněk Ostomský is from Pfizer, Executive Director of Research at Pfizer, Stephen Lederman at Agilent. Katrina's still here, and Joydeep, of course, Joydeep Goswami. Joydeep Goswami from Invitrogen. So would you like to just, the three of you who have not been here before, could you just give us a sense of what you feel about the current state of the business? Has anything changed since the last meeting? Has the fact that the economy has gone south made a problem? What's the situation in terms of research? Are you optimistic, pessimistic? All those issues. Just a quick capsule statement from you.
Yes, so I may start. So I represent Pfizer, which is sort of a big pharmaceutical company. It says UC San Diego, so it's a cryptic way how to get into this business. So there was a big change since last year that Pfizer actually recognized, as probably many other companies, the potential importance of cellular therapy. So there was a officially established research unit actually starting in April of this year, which is called Pfizer Regenerative Medicine. And by design, it's meant to be a small biotech-like operation which would actually proactively look at the opportunities, collaboration with academic places, and to make sense from, you know, what may be a useful therapy. So actually, Inder Verma mentioned with certain skepticism, it's not easy to get a drug. I wrote it down here. So here we are. We would like to actually to provide tool compounds to collaborators. And so this is one part, regenerative medicine. And as you know, there is a lot of confusion in the field also in terms of cancer stem cells. This is something which we are heavily involved in actually here in La Jolla. A little introduction, Pfizer actually consolidated their oncology operations fully into La Jolla site, so we are in the middle, as was mentioned, of this great biotech environment. And cancer stem cells is an important area of research currently, actually started roughly a year and a half ago. But again, it is going to be done through strategically designed collaboration. So we have one established actually with Catriona's group at UCSD. Another one is with, there is a McGowan Institute of Regenerative Medicine, University of Pittsburgh. So they have wonderful, potentially useful three-dimensional bioreactor model where you would be able to recreate a niche, environmental niche, which was sort of mentioned here and so on. So to summarize, Pfizer is excited. This looks like a area which where the future potentially will be, both in treating cancer, which is probably more realistic. I think the regenerative medicine, I wouldn't be that optimistic in terms of short term, but both of those areas are covered by us.
Stephen?
Yeah, I also feel that it's been a year of great progress that creates increased enthusiasm on our part. I can put it really in the context of the meeting today. It was a wonderful day of really inspirational science. And I think the kind of work that the oral and poster presenters and their teams have done is really a significant component in making this a very exciting time for people in the field of developing and creating biomolecular measurement systems. I think there's obviously a very broad spectrum of scientific and technological advances and applications, and a very wide diversity, therefore, of approaches to making progress and different ways of incorporating measurement within that. And that creates a lot of different kinds of opportunities, many of which no doubt will become very important. And so I think that also fuels a very positive sense on our part that an important part of our life science tools for the future should go in the direction of areas that matter most here. It was also very gratifying to see the adoption of many relatively new measurement systems that were generated only in part, I would say, for stem cell research community, for broader related areas in human genetics, in genomics and proteomics, metabolomics, informatics associated with that. They're really being adopted here for good reason, as you all can understand. And even some fields like molecular diagnostics share some motivations that, for example, for comprehensive genomic measurement of smaller and smaller samples, that's of great interest in merging high-resolution methods in clinical genetics based on known markers for known diseases. And I think we had an example this morning from the first speaker of a component of work that he brought up towards the end was a rather comprehensive genetic analysis of a single human embryonic stem cell, as that measurement being an important part of the strategy and validation of the sample for continuing forward. So that's kind of an example that illustrates not only are these drivers towards comprehensive molecular measurement for smaller and smaller samples congruent with the parallel needs of, say, clinical biomedicine, but actually can intersect and be almost identical or just overlap in a research and development application. So there's very exciting progress in the field and a very real incorporation of challenging measurements, which gives us a lot of opportunity to do better for you as we develop new methods and help progress together.
Yeah. Joydeep?
Well, I guess a lot has been said already. You know, I think this has been really a fantastic year in terms of the scientific progress. And in my mind, there are a couple of things that are coming together. Obviously, most people talk about IPS, but really the excitement for me is Yamanaka's discovery really has opened up the whole world of cellular reprogramming, which, you know, even a couple of years ago, people didn't think was possible, and now it's opened up this whole new possibility of studying things almost by perturbing the system a little bit and then bringing it back, rather than, you know, starting at the starting level of iPS cells and or embryonic stem cells and bringing it forward. So that's been a great advance. I think the other piece of this, which of course is often missed in the whole hoopla of iPS cells, is the whole world of epigenetic analysis and really wiping the slate clean, if you will. And that again opens up whole new doors, and not only just in understanding developmental biology, but also on the cancer side. I think it's, you know, tremendously important. I'm very excited in, of course, looking at the talks today, but and the discoveries of the last year, that this is moving to a state where we are finally beginning to understand some of the magic of stem cells, if you will. And of course, you know, that leads to the insights that Katrina and other people talked about today on the cancer side. I think with the you know, being in a public company that serves this field, along with the fantastic discoveries that have been made in the last year, you're also seeing, unfortunately, a huge tightening of the economic markets here. And on what that is, at least what we're seeing, and of course others in this room can probably attest to that, is an inability or an unwillingness to take risk from the private sector to the extent that this particular field would probably demand. And hopefully this is a temporary blip, but we are seeing even the venture capital community, the public markets, all becoming much more risk-averse. And I don't think in the long run this is a good thing for this country, and I think for this particular field. I will tell you it's a little bit different if you go into some of the emerging markets, but, you know, we'll see where this lands up, but I'm hoping that this risk averseness actually goes away very soon.
Steve, sure.
I just to put an extra aspect to that I no doubt you may well agree with. I think we heard a lot today, very explicitly this morning, but throughout the day, about how stem cell research and technology is going to revolutionize human biology and the investigation of human biology. I think that aspect could fare well even under very dire economic situations, because it changes the way of doing human biology, which is still compelling to do regardless of the economic cycle, in ways that can be more cost-effective or more efficient or more rich.
How do you get that point across, though? Because I think you'd probably agree, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, that the huge impetus that engendered public support for stem cells was because people think they're going to get cured. So how do you do that if you're not getting VCs help companies start up to develop cures?
Well, I think, Roger, they're coming. And you know, I think the current economic climate is a terrible disaster. There's no doubt about it. But you know, we're about to award a whole lot of grants in tools and technologies, and the private sector came in strongly, and they're strongly represented in those that really, you know, were very highly ranked. And I see you listen to the talks today, and you see that. The nature of the way that the biotech companies are facing, you know, they want to be part. They want to be part linked in. This is one of the ways in which, you know, it's going to work. We do need the basic researchers linked to the biotech companies, and we do need the, you know, the public funding systems like CIRM, and it's all. I think the paradigm is going to slip and change again, and and while it'll be different, and maybe some of the smaller biotechs won't survive. You know that in the past, a lot of them didn't survive anyway. They come up on very high-risk opportunities and fade away out on that. So while I think it's a disaster, I think it's also another paradigm movement. And with a new president and with a new system, I think there'll be oxygen pumped into this whole area, which make it take off in a very partnership-linked way. And I'm very optimistic. I really am.
Yeah, Katrina, you had something. But then when you said that, just to follow up, what I was getting at there is there a sort of a re-strategizing that has to go on now? Obviously, right. Many companies are doing that because of this huge disaster as you're talking about. So how does it affect this industry? But you had something.
Yeah, I guess because I did too much transplant. But I like to take a negative and look at the potential positive ramifications of it. And one good thing that's come out of this poor economic environment is it's forced us to work together from disparate fields, not just within science, but also within to create industry-academia partnerships that may not have existed otherwise. So it is able to accelerate the time clock, so we're able to get things into the clinical arena faster. And thanks to the oxygen pumping by CIRM, we're actually able to get this stuff done. So I think that it's a potential bonus. I mean, it's horrible to think of that way, you know, with the economic situation, but to actually get us to work together because of lower funding and have industry and academia working as partners to develop clinical trials, it means that will actually help our economy. Because if we have more effective, more targeted therapies, we're less likely to see the atomic bomb blast type of carnage that we've seen with the other types of therapies that we've been involved in that are excessively expensive, not just in terms of mortality, but actual cost in terms of insurance. So I think that there are better, more effective, more resourceful ways to do things. And I think if we combine our skills to do that, we'll get there. So it's that yes, we can mantra. Right. Well, this is the place to do it.
Yeah. As I said to some people last night, just picking up on that, let me just stop for a moment. How many of you in the room are actually academic scientists, researchers? And how many of you are industry scientists? Right. So I was mentioning last night that there has been, and still, I think it's still there, there's a website which is www.sciencedebate.com, sciencedebate2008.com. And that was put together by actually a couple of scientists and a couple of journalists, a couple of screenwriters. And the idea was to try and get a science debate before the election. But they weren't able to do it, in fact. But they did manage to get together a huge coalition of pretty much every major scientific organization in this country, and most of the Nobel laureates and so on as well. into a sort of a grassroots organization that then produced a series of questions for the candidates. And you can find on that website responses to 14 areas, 14 questions responded to by Obama and McCain. And it's interesting, I'm just thinking about the general sense that the public isn't interested in science. The story, the actual categories were innovation in science and technology. There was one on climate change. There was another one on energy. There's another one on global warming specifically, one on health, one on research. But there was also an entire question devoted to stem cells. And it might be worth your while just having a look at that to get some sense of. That's just following up on your Yes We Can thing. ScienceDebate2008.com. Alan, there was this interview with you in Wired magazine, which you obviously weren't so present for, but
supposedly,
which said, this was earlier this year, that said this is the first year that business can compete for CERM grants, right? In the past, they haven't turned out in large numbers to participate in CERM programs. There's more need to be done in that area. And what you said was, Big Pharma has been moving here with their flags flapping about. We need to engage them. I think there's been some resistance because of the issues of intellectual property. There's going to be a lot more work done on that. I'm going to get involved because I have a background in starting up companies and so on and so forth. Is that still an issue, the intellectual property stuff? Are there still any back barriers? It sounds as though you've had a good response here, but...
Well, I think maybe Zendik should answer that. His company's in the midst of that. Look, I think it is an issue, but it's an issue that private companies deal with in due course. And yes, there are patents. It's a bit of a minefield or wombat hole, strewn paddock of patents. But that's the reality. And I know that they deal with that. And at some point in time, you know, they decide to either get rights or they persuade whoever's holding the patents. You know, that's a reasonable way of dealing with it. And so I understand that will happen. What is odd at the moment, I suppose, is for, say, the Wharf patents. It's a free go in Europe. You know, they're not at this stage. I don't think they're, they've been agreed to. So we've got a bit of an uneven deck.
I could just interject there. I mean, what you were saying earlier in your talk. I mean, one sees this global financial collapse and eventually a global response. I mean, is there some parallel here where you think you can actually still generate some sort of a global response in? Partnerships and stem cells.
Well, in a sense of global partnerships, yes. And I think we do work in a global space. So while we're so supportive and of ourselves in California, the rest of the world does exist, and it's got great science in it too. So we understand that, and so do the big biotech companies and pharma companies. I think the reality is that they will deal with it, and I'm very confident that they're going to deal with it. We decided perhaps we shouldn't get too immersed in it because they're very good at solving those kind of problems. They've been there for a very long time doing that. My own view is that those rights ought to be made at reasonable rates, and if they did it like a PCR, we'd be all fine and we'd get on with life, and people who held the patents would do well, and the rest of us would get on with science. I think that is the situation. But Zondek, you've been in that space.
Yeah, I would agree that it will sort itself out in terms of intellectual property rights and so on. To be a little controversial here, I think there is another danger. I mean, you mentioned this unfavorable financial climate, shortage of money for funding, that people would tend to oversell what they can actually deliver in order to get the funding. And in a standard conversation, people are stressing, we have to accelerate, get the things to clinic as fast as possible. On one hand, on the other hand, we know FDA and public basically expects no side effects, completely safe, and so on. And the more we know about stem cells, both from the sort of regenerative medicine standpoint, but also from cancer stem cells, the more basic biology, especially the etiology, what makes a particle stem cell or progenitor cell convert into this malignant phenotype, And is there and talking to people who are actually considering some of the clinical trials, so they are aware that if, for instance, how to prevent, especially if you imagine expanding ex vivo, using some exotic compounds possibly, or mitogens, how to sort of avoid diverting portion of your therapeutic dose into a cancer line. And so you may, I mean, I'm going to simplify, you may try to replenish beta cells in the pancreas, but you can actually give somebody a pancreatic cancer, which is incurable. So again, I apologize for the simplification. So there is a danger that if an over-enthusiastic investigator gets the funding and jumps into clinic too fast with those unintended consequences, that there is a danger that the whole field may be actually held back for many years to sort it out. You know, we had the gene therapy case several years ago. So I think this is important to manage the expectations, focus on the basic science. I think we are still very, very early in terms of understanding what we can or cannot deliver.
Just to follow up on that point, I don't wish to be doom and gloom, but just I know people have asked me this. If the investment goes down because of the financial crisis, and it doesn't appear as though cures are appearing as rapidly as they were originally promised, then what do people do? Do they go somewhere else? Joydeep?
You know, there's always a danger, right? I think that's the issue of living in a global world where China's only a flight away, and not all of this is bad, right? There's cost pressures in the United States, and you have seen global what do they call that health tourism arise here. I think the danger that was brought up earlier is very real. You know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to validate the work that's done on the research side to make sure that it's safe. But I also think that's ultimately the danger of being too conservative, by the way, not just on the financial community, but also from the point of view of the FDA, right, which I think seems to at least think that in most of the cases, all the work that needs to prove that a drug is safe needs to happen before the drug is launched. And you know, repeatedly you see the problem of that strategy that, you know, the statistics just don't work, and they're only going to get worse when you get into therapies like cell therapy or stem cell therapy, because your statistics are going to be smaller and smaller. So I think this issue of, you know, you have to have strike a balance between being too conservative and seeing the work come up in places where the regulatory environment is less stringent, and I think you will see some of that happen. You know, but I think there's a danger to being too conservative here and setting the expectation that everything that's going to come out right up front is going to be safe, right? I just don't think that's going to work in the long run.
Are there any immediate, I don't know how to phrase this, strategies that companies could now, like yours could now use that would be improve efficiency or something?
There are, and I think the issue is one, and I think Katrina is exactly right. Right, in when you go into a constrained environment, you start getting very focused on what do you really have to do, right? And you know, all of the peripheral activities of you know, I can optimize this or optimize that go away. I think therapeutic companies start focusing on the therapies or the therapeutic aspects of things. And companies like Invitrogen, which are not therapeutic companies, also start focusing a lot on what are the, how do we make reagents safe? And so, you know, we have started seeing the shift. I think we ourselves have shifted our strategy quite radically over the last couple of years to say, you know, no matter what, even if we introduce stem cell reagents in the research domain, there has to be a clear path towards having those be clinically approvable. That actually does not always mean that they have to be animal origin free, but just that they have to be eventually can be certified by the FDA that they're traceable and trackable and they're you know, free of pathogens. So that's one way I think people are definitely looking at that. I think the other aspect of stem cells, which has been discussed here in past panels, is this opens a door towards getting better cellular models in the hands of scientists. And it's not just about the stem cells will have much larger implications than just on the cellular therapy side of things, right? I think you will see start seeing companies like Pfizer or Lilly or others move eventually to these better screening models and come out with drugs hopefully faster and cheaper than they're available today. So I do think that move will occur. I think, though, the pain in the short term is inevitable, and I think people just need to realize that.
I mean, Roger, I think we need to recognize that the companies, the big companies that are putting up, you know, these initial clinical trials have done a massive amount of work. They really have. And while, you know, I've not read the 23,000 pages and so forth of some of these submissions, you know, there's an enormous amount of effort gone in, and I think, you know, every time that people will go up for, say, an embryonic stem cell trial, there will be a massive amount of data needed. Not so much, it seems not so much for adult stem cells, and we have neural stem cells in trial for Batten's disease and so on. So, look, you know, I think the it might be, you know, it's very important that we make these cells safe from the point of view of teratomas. But I'd be just as worried about how well we grow this large bank of cells that they don't contain any surprises in the cells for other things. But essentially, you know, I'm comfortable that the FDA has got a pretty high bar, and I think the companies are doing a magnificent job in doing that and getting over that bar. So I really think it's, again, you know, there's a very good system that's been put in place here in the US and in many other developed countries that I think will end up giving you evidence-based medicine. And so what will happen with the non-medicine-based medicine that you can go off and have in other places will hopefully fade out. But if you've got very sick kids and there's nothing that anyone can offer you, it's very hard, you know, not to want to go somewhere to just try. I mean, you know, it is it's a human reality, unfortunately.
I was just thinking that given that climate, that CERM must now look like an absolute godsend.
It is.
Let's just, I mean, just ask Duane Roth, who obviously is CEO of Connect and responsible for much of this.
So sitting here today and listening to this panel right now, I was just thinking, in my entire career, I've never seen conditions better for a technology. You listened to today and you heard the science. I mean, people are crawling all over these problems into great, great detail, and it's making tremendous advances. The population, the public, wants this more than we do. And if you talk to anybody who's sick, and the pull that you're going to get here, it's not yet another chemotherapeutic agent. This is a chance to make it yesterday for all these people. So those conditions, you take those together, and then you think about the other conditions, the remaining investment that has to be done, and you start to think about regulation and risk-benefit. And every patient group I talk to today who's talking about raising money and supporting things, I ask them if they'll take some time to let the Food and Drug Administration and their delegation in Congress know that they care about risk-benefit and they're willing to take the risk, even though it may not go right the first time. So get prepared for that because it's very important. And then the final one is who's going to pay? And to me, that's one thing that requires all of us sit down and become pretty innovative about how we create incentives here that will cause that investment to happen. Because government alone can't pay for all that. This is going to have to be the private sector. So I think gloom and doom, yeah, we're all concerned about investment, but this is the best investment opportunity I've seen in my lifetime in healthcare. And I think if we keep making the progress underneath, that the middle will take place and we'll get to the end.
Questions, comments? Alan Lewis, of course you would have a comment, wouldn't you? No.
Well, I've got an investment for you, Duane. Novacell. But we'll talk about it later. But, you know, you make a very positive point. You know, it's phenomenally optimistic. It's the future, and it's very exciting. But I'm here, and I'm looking over there, and I got to get to there. And thank God for Alan Townsend and CIRM, because that gives us the life belt to get to a point where the investors will take part. They're not going to do it short for the near term, I don't think. The pharma companies, perhaps with the exception of Pfizer, we've been told that some pharma won't even work on embryonic stem cells because their investors don't like it. And that's true. So it's still, the pharma is slowly adopting, like they were with monoclonal antibodies. It took them an awfully long time to adopt that technology, which is, you know, very important today, obviously. So whilst I'm not pessimistic, with that, you do not want to be a stem cell company anywhere other than California right now, because you do have an opportunity, and you know it's no other than that, because Alan's not guaranteeing that they're going to support NovoCell for the next X years. But it's rather gloomy for getting investments. So we can be very optimistic, and the only people that are going to translate the technology are probably the little companies. So I know Katrina has been very fortunate to work with Targagen with their molecule, but you know, there aren't many of us that are going to be around unless the investors come into the picture.
And actually, I wanted to underscore that point. Even for sustaining the clinical trial, even though you have a drug that looks great, that little company has to survive. Somebody has to want to pick it up and not wait till phase three. You know, so what I hope is that both a physician and a scientist is that we'll do the right thing and get these drugs that do look very good further ahead.
Han Chu from CMX Capital. I've always been a strong supporter of stem cells, and I've been involved in more of the financial and investment community. I wanted to bring up what I think is a rather controversial issue and would be interested in your thoughts on this. So when I was very active supporting stem cells with among my venture colleagues, one comment came up which relates to curative therapies, and I think is pretty obvious to a number of you. By the very nature, a curative therapy cures a patient and thereby has no recurring revenue stream. And as a result of that, at least a number of my investor friends said they were not really interested because it had high margins and no recurring revenue stream. And I imagine that a curative therapy might also have some interesting consequences for some of the pharmaceutical companies that make a lot of money off of some of these diseases that we would hope to cure. And so I feel that that potentially creates a conundrum, a potential issue, and perhaps a structural problem within the industry. I'd be interested in your comments.
I think you make a good point, because I see it as a roadblock. If you're going to get all of these things that we heard about today and more through to the clinic, it's a big cost. It is really a big cost. And of course, you're going to put cells into people, and presumably we'll have to, you know, observe them for longer for the safety features, because it's not like a drug, it doesn't decay away. So we're very mindful of that, and we believe that, you know, that there needs to be some rearrangement here, that the beneficiaries, the specific beneficiaries of cures, for example, are the government and the health insurance industry. And we think that they should contribute, and we're working with them and with big government to talk more about it. And we have the support of, you know, people in Pfizer and other companies have given us, you know, the verbal support that they think this is something useful. If we could create a major fund that would help in the development of these things, it would then take you know, the edge off the you know, seeing the business, because it's difficult for some investors to see a business coming a cure if it just involves a single dose of cells in an outpatient. If that ever happens, if it's as simple as that, it's hard to see the business model. Look, I think it's going to happen. It has to happen, because it's really quite difficult otherwise to see how you could actually get all of these applications through the clinical trials. And so it's a matter for us and others to see if we can encourage some change in the investor base system to help in that.
Yeah, so can I comment a little bit there? Because I think this is a very, very important consideration, but clearly pharmaceutical companies are aware of this. So I think good example is in cancer therapy. So there is clearly, if your response rate is 10%, and there are increasing prices of the drugs, like Avastin in certain countries is not prescribed because basically we are talking several months extension, statistically speaking. So the way out of it, and this is part of, for instance, Pfizer oncology strategy, is actually through increased science, patient segmentation, so that you actually give the right drug to the right patient. And working with the insurance company, the hope is if the response rate for that particular segment of the patient population would be 90%, so that the insurers would be willing to pay because you will cure those people. So clearly those prices would be higher, but either people or the insurers would be willing to pay for it. I think the discrepancy is only when the prices of drugs go up, but the response rate stays sort of dismal, like in most cancer treatments.
I just wanted to make a couple of points as well. The same issue came up when we were doing bone marrow transplants, or, you know, when E. Donald Thomas introduced bone marrow transplants and eventually won the Nobel Prize for them for leukemia, the idea was it was too expensive. Nobody could ever do that. There were special ethical review boards that are still in place today. But the reality is it costs $350,000 to do a bone marrow transplant, which seems really expensive. But if you nickel and dime these people with chemotherapy that's not even effective, it costs $1 million. So the insurance company started to realize, wait a minute, that's a cost saving. Government started to realize that's a cost saving. And I think that when you look at how Gleevec was developed, that was a drug that was going to be good for 1 in 100,000 people in this country for a disease, CML, that's rather rare. So there was some discussion about whether to develop a drug that looked like it was going to be extremely effective and whether or not they would capture enough of a profit that way. It's a $2 billion a year market because they captured the world market. So I think when you start to apply economics arguments to whether or not to develop something scientifically, it can be very short-sighted. So I think if we all really delve deeply into the science and see what makes sense, I think what comes from stem cell research isn't going to just be cellular therapeutics. I think that we're going to understand more about how these regenerative processes work and be able to devise small molecule inhibitors or agonists that allow these processes to take place, as we've seen in the iPS field, where they're able to reprogram cells. So there's a lot that will come from this research that we may not be able to entirely anticipate at the moment, but I think will be a great...
I mean, a classic example is that If we were still looking after polio patients, it would cost California about $2 billion a year in health insurance or government subsidies. So, you know, if a cure is made for diabetes, you will save that. And so I think that's the simplicity of the argument, that the beneficiaries need to become involved, and they need to be involved in, you know, helping us get up this climb in a clinical trial. It is going to be expensive, and we do need help, and we need to work to get it.
Yeah. I could make a fairly amusing movie if I took the last picture, the last frame of almost every science talk. It's a picture of a happy, smiling group of people, and the person is saying, "And these are the people in the lab who did all the work." If you remember. Right? Which means that most of the scientific presenters here were just spokespeople for the lab, really. No. Clearly they do the work. But my point here is about the people who you said did all the work. In other words, the students and the postdocs and the graduate students coming in. And this applies to industry as well. Ken Chen's point from earlier, the difficulty of needing to have an MD and a PhD and the length and the finances and so on in this climate... Are you worried about this, or are we
still paying off debt from this?
From the industry's point of view, can you bring in enough of the next generation? Is there a problem with that?
You mean recruiting people or funding the research? Which aspect are you talking about?
Funding them. It's a two-stage process, isn't it? First of all, they're getting qualified to be able to be employed by you, and then having enough slots for people to learn the trade, essentially.
You know, I think, you were talking earlier about CIRM being a boon in this climate, and actually not just CIRM, but other governments actually making investments in stem cells is really great, because that's what creates the base of talent that you know, folks both in academia and in industry actually rely on to push the field forward. You know, I think industry and academia will, again, always face the same problem as where do you invest your money, right? And I think, like the gentleman there was pointing out, for industry, this is one of returns eventually, right? You can't keep putting money in with no returns, otherwise the Wall Street will come after you faster than you know, you can say anything. So there's always this choice we make of what will pay out in the long term, what pays out in the short term, and all companies have to balance that. And I don't see this as a particular challenge with stem cells. I think, again, we understand in Vitrogen that there is a long-term research benefit. And I think part of that is the benefit of also working with individuals outside the company, collaborating with them to move the field forward. And you know, it has knock-on benefits, which are not just sales of certain reagents or any of that nature, right? But we do invest in long-term research. And I think that will continue.
So you think there'll be a fourth annual stem cell meeting on the Mesa?
We certainly hope so.
And Vitrogen is the lead sponsor.
But of course, according to you, this is the fourth annual one.
So we're almost at the end. Just a final thought here from Alan.
Well, I think I'm incredibly optimistic. It was just great science, delivered by people with fantastic morale. And I mean, it just is a spiritually enhancing to come and listen to good science in this area. And so, you know, I feel really, really good. And I think California has got something very special going here, despite, you know, some very tough times out in the private sector. But we've been through it before. Californians are a can-do place. And I, you know, as an Australian, you know, ending up in California this year, trying to buy a house and so on, you got to be can do to be Californian, and so I think it's a fantastic environment, and as long as the board keeps me on, I'll enjoy every moment of it. So this kind of meeting is great, it just shows you the progress that we're making, the pace that's on. I think it's wonderful.
The others, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I would actually maybe mention one positive consequence of this financial sort of difficulties we have, that companies, for instance, are very unlikely to try to establish, for instance, in this stem cells area, their internal operations fully staffed and funded. They would actually increasingly look outside and establish those very important connections. We started doing it, and we want to do more of it with academic, you know, top-notch places. And for that actually to work, I think there are two things which need to happen, that pharma people should appreciate the sign that there are really scientific problems to be solved. But on the other hand, also the academic people should try to understand how, you know, pharmaceutical companies actually think, not see them only as an easy source of money and we'll do our papers and they'll pay us, you know. So there should be some understanding that we have a joint purpose, and I think that partnership long-term would be very successful.
Yeah, I think that's something that Duane has been particularly keen on working on as well.
So I was going to add something really about that joint purpose. A number of people have spoken appropriately this year as last on working together across academia and industry. You asked earlier, how do we educate the funding agencies or those who can become funding agencies on the broad and immense importance of all of this. And so I think, you know, a number of people have said also in various ways, and we've seen today how basic science is really, if you will, the progenitor of the applications. So I think industry is prepared to join with academics and research funding institutions to help educate the population and the country and the government of how important basic research is in this area. I think we can, if we orchestrate things correctly, companies of various kinds can help you ensure that there's sound basic science funding from public sources in this country. It's very important to us as it is to the academics.
Yeah, I think that next year at this time when we have this conference again, which I think we will, I'd like to bring a patient and just get their point of view and see somebody who's actually benefited from the results of this research. I did that to a class I was teaching on Friday, and everybody was having an absence seizure or going, oh, do we have to listen to this? And then I said, a friend has joined us at the back, and this patient who's been on this clinical trial that was partly funded by CIRM came down to the front, and everybody just woke up, these first-year medical students and pharmacy students, and he's responding very well. So I think when you see somebody, when you see the tangible benefits of stem cell research that you can get at that malignant clone and eradicate that from somebody and not have that Damocles sword hanging over their head so they won't have to worry about transforming to leukemia or having some other nasty outcome, and they start to use phrases like getting back into the dance of woodwork. You know, I didn't know woodwork was a dance, but apparently it's something that he really enjoys. So it's not just a matter of quantity of life, it's quality of life, and that's really what we're trying to give people. So I think that industry and academia have similar, you know, a similar goal here, but I think we can sound very maudlin about these diseases. I think if we bring somebody in next time who's actually got something that could be a target of stem cell research, it'll help to expand the forum and redirect us, because the patients that come in are extremely well informed now. They're also very well organized. So you can't be cynical or uninformed anymore as a scientist or as a physician or as an investor or as somebody in a pharmaceutical agency, because these people know what's going on and they talk to each other. So if some clinical trial isn't going well, they know Betty got it and it didn't work. So it raises the bar, and it makes us all have to be a little bit more honest about not only expectations but outcomes. And so primum non nocere, which means above all do no harm, but part of doing harm is not trying to do anything. So I think in this field we're trying to do something pretty special, and it's a complex field, but I think the patients understand that there's inherent risk, but they're the ones suffering with potentially lethal diseases. So I don't think we should take the choice away from them.
Joydeep, last word.
No, I think I would echo what Katrina said, and I think what Duane was saying earlier, right? This is a way of treatment that's very different than what we have seen in the past, and the kinds of diseases and how we treat them is very different. I think the science will get done, just because I think there, you know, there is funding, there is enthusiasm in the thing, and there are brilliant scientists that are here and, of course, elsewhere in the world that are doing it. I don't have a doubt about that. I do think, though, this will take organization in a way that has not been seen before to move the insurance agencies, which, of course, the U.S. is certain to see a change in that paradigm, because, it, you know, at some point this is not going to work. And it will take maybe a change in how the FDA views, you know, how these trials go through and how they're, you know, how the drugs are approved or the therapies are approved. And that will take a combination of scientists, a combination of industry, and, of course, you know, the patient population and the interested parties itself. So maybe next year that becomes a little bit of a theme in how we conduct these things.
So, yes, becoming merchants of light, as I said at the very beginning. All right. Thank you so much to all the panels. Thank you very much to Connect and Duane Roth, and especially Holly Garrett. I'll just say that again, and especially to Holly Garrett, who did so much work on this, and Katie Keenan at the Science Network. And thank you all for being here. See you next year. Thank you.